We can take a look at a brain that's very sensitive to the effects of opioids, and can we compare it to a brain that's very non-sensitive to the effects of opioids, and can we make that brain that's super sensitive turn it into a brain that's not sensitive, if you will.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of In Plain English. I am your host, Jamie Moffa, and today we are going to be talking about a very interesting paper called Dynamic Rhythmogenic Network States Drive Differential Opioid Responses in the In Vitro Respiratory Network by our expert for today, Nicholas Burgraff et al. So, Nicholas, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, that sounds like a cool paper. I'm Nick. I'm currently a postdoc at Seattle Children's Research Institute in Seattle Children's. I'm at the Center for Integrative Brain Research. And so I'm in primarily a neuroscience department, a neuroscience, neurophysiology sort of focused department. But my background was in whole animal physiology. I originally started working on goats and looking at how our brain controls our breathing. And then that was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and then at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and then came to Seattle, and then transitioned to a sort of a more commonplace model of rodents, and still focused on the neural control of breathing. And so one of the things that we naturally focus on a lot is the opioid epidemic, because the main reason that you die is because you stop breathing from the opioids. And so anybody that studies the neural control of breathing is quite well poised to, I guess, start to tackle that problem. And so that's sort of how we jumped into the opioid pandemic and looked at how different ways the opioid shut down our brain's ability to breathe and different ways to overcome that. So that's sort of, I guess, a quick little scientific journey of how we're here and who I am. And then in August, my lab will be opening at University of Wisconsin. So,
hey, congrats. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So thank you for joining us on the show. And actually, way back in undergrad, I got my start in research in a breathing electrophysiology lab. So this is kind of tying in my current research in opioids with my past interest in breathing. And that's exciting. So we have two wonderful guests in the studio with us today. Our first guest is Gabby. Gabby, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, thank you. My name is Gabby Sullins, she, her, or they, them pronouns. And I am a programmer. I don't do any research in anything other than, you know, maybe how to make things crash less when I write code. And I live in St. Louis.
Cool. Yeah. Well, so thanks for being on the show. And then last but not least, we have James Reed. James, would you like to give us a brief introduction?
Hi, my name is James, in fact, and I am an anatomist. So it seems like I would know a lot about this paper, but the dirty little secret about anatomy is that once we get inside the skull, we kind of stop pretending we know what's happening. And we kind of turn that over to the neuroscientists. So I'm excited to have this be another opportunity for me to work past my neurophobia, which is still alive and kicking, which is very exciting for me. And I'm also a podcaster. I do a science communication podcast on the side too. So excited to communicate some science as well.
Yeah, well, let's get into it. Nick, let's talk about this paper.
Yeah, let's paint the story. I guess I should add that I also have the Neural Network podcast as well. So if anybody's interested in loosely neurophysiology or jujitsu things, that's kind of where it's at. Anyways, yeah, I guess during the a little bit of the intro, I kind of got into how we got into the opioids. But I guess, you know, when I started in Seattle as a fresh right postdoc, I was given a project, as many are. And the project was take out some brains, record from the site that generates the rhythmic oscillations for you to breathe, and figure out a drug that reverses the opioid effect.
What an ambitious project.
Yeah. And so basically, you had to learn how to take out brains, and then you have to record from them in a dish. And little known secret, the brainstem has an area that I guess it's controversial to say pacemaker, but everybody knows what pacemaking means largely in terms of comparing it to your heart. So basically, there's an area within the brainstem called the pre-Botzinger complex. It's located within a larger ventral respiratory column, as they call it. But essentially, it has a rhythmogenic oscillator within it. So it acts similar to a pacemaker like the heart. But it does it within the brainstem, and it tells you when to take a breath. And so every time it sends these rhythmic oscillatory bursts, as we call them. So there's just like these big, all the neurons within that area kind of fire these fast trains of action potentials at the same time for a short period of time. And that burst gets transmitted down to the phrenic nerve to eventually innervate your diaphragm to tell you to take a breath. And so it does that very rhythmically, and that's what helps you to breathe. But the cool thing is when you take a brainstem out and you cut it, you can record from that area and it'll keep doing the same thing as it was in the brain outside of the head. And just as if there was a fully functional set of lungs and diaphragm, but there's not. So it's just, you know, it's still telling you to breathe, but there's just nothing left to breathe. And so you can study the ability of that rhythmogenic core or that pacemaking network in order to generate these rhythmic signals that tell you when to take a breath quite intricately, because you don't have to worry about a lot of the feedback mechanisms that come with in vivo preparation or a whole animal type of preparation. And so that's what a lot of this was focused on. And so, like I said, when I started as a postdoc, I was told, you know, take these brainstems out, record from this area that tells you when to take a breath, put some opioids on it, which we know shuts down that ability of that brainstem region to form breaths, which is the primary cause of death from the opioids. You have a opioid-induced respiratory depression, as they call it. So essentially, you put on the opioid, that area of the brain stops sending out those rhythmic booms that it usually does. And so you have no signals generated to tell your diaphragm to take a breath. And so you just stop breathing, right? And so your brain just essentially stops telling you to take a breath, and that's how you die. And so we had a big laundry list of drugs that might be able to reverse the effects of that in order to sort of kickstart rhythm generation again. And so it was just going down the list and trying different drugs that would kickstart the rhythm. But of course, if it was that was simple, then it wouldn't have been a cool story. So when I started taking out the brainstems, that's the problem, right? You have a really nice like science thing that works really good, but it's not a good story. So you have to go with like the controversial stuff. That's the that's where it's at. So I took out all these brainstems, and okay, yeah, they're forming these rhythmic oscillations that you can record from the neurons that tell your brain when to take a breath. But when I put on the opioids, it was like maybe half of them actually shut down. Some of them actually sped up, and so there was this like wild large degree of variation. And so classically within the literature, what happens is oftentimes you just take the group of brainstems that has the rhythm generating capacity shut down when the opioids are applied, and then you add some drugs to see if it reverses it. But the problem is you're throwing out like half of the actual data, right? And so maybe you might be able to justify it and say, well, we're only interested in finding cures for the brains that are being shut down by the opioids, because obviously if they weren't being overdosed, then, you know, they weren't shutting down, then there's no reason to treat them. But when you're trying to get at the actual mechanism of how opioids are acting and how you can actually reverse it, you kind of have to take into account all of the brains. And so that's sort of what I did. And that's kind of partially my bias when it comes to a lot of science things, is include all of the data if you have the data. Just because it doesn't conform to your hypothesis doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that your hypothesis may not be all encompassing, you know? And so some of that came from the goats, where you only got like one animal a year. And so through hell or high water, you're taking that data, that data. You don't have a choice. But anyway, so I had all these brains and they were all doing different things when I stuck on the opioids. And, you know, I was sort of banging my head against the wall for a while, because, you know, at that point you got to get a fellowship grant if you want to, you know, move on. And so it's like, I kind of need something to work. But so I thought, okay, well, to hell with it, trying to figure out what drug is going to reverse the opioid. We'll figure that out later. First, we have to actually figure out what's going on with the opioids itself. And so instead of looking at the variability as being something that might be a bug of the system, if you will, look at the variability as something that might be a feature of the sensitivity to the opioids themselves. Like, is there something that we can take a look at a brain that's very sensitive to the effects of opioids
And can we compare it to a brain that's very non-sensitive to the effects of opioids? And can we make that brain that's super sensitive, turn it into a brain that's not sensitive, if you will? So what's different between these two brains, and how can we change the state of the network itself, of this neural network that's driving our breathing, in order to change how sensitive they are to the opioids? And so that's sort of how that project morphed into what it was. And so that's the path that we ended up driving down. And that's why the title is the Dynamic Rhythmogenic Network States. So the states of the network being what makes a certain network more or less sensitive to the opioids. And so it became trying to define those different rhythmogenic states of the respiratory network. So that's sort of the picture that we painted with the story. If we actually dive into the paper itself, if anybody has the paper, I'm looking at figure one, if you really want to look at it, but I'll do my best to illustrate it without, you know, doing some sort of vocal interpretive dance for everybody. Yeah. So basically, like, the first part of the paper was just actually defining the variability in the response to opioids within this rhythmogenic network within the brainstem. So I say rhythmogenic network, I just mean a neural network. So a network of like 800-ish or so neurons that form that pacemaking core. And that those neurons themselves, we just call them sort of like a network. So one network amongst many networks of neural networks. It's just networks all over the place. Small ones, big ones. Yeah, the whole brain's a network, if you want to call it one. But so what we did is we took the brainstems out, we made a slice. There's different ways to slice the brain, but the brain does stay alive when you take it out, if as long as you put it in artificial cerebral spinal fluid, or a brain Kool-Aid, as we call it sometimes, or brain Gatorade.
Oh, I like that.
It's just like a mixture of electrolytes and sugar and stuff that's enough to relatively mimic the cerebral spinal fluid that your brain is normally bathing in. But you can take the brains out really fast, put them in there, and it'll stay alive for quite a long time. I mean, like upwards of a day or two if you're liberal about it.
If you're pushing it.
If you're pushing it, yeah. After a while, the enzymes start to kind of eat it away. But because once you make a cut, you cut through a lot of neurons, and so there's a lot of sort of enzymes that sort of spill out and start to break things down. But
this is wild. This is. The fact that we're just casually talking about how we can functionally create zombies is pretty amazing. And we're just kind of glossing over this as one very small part of this larger paper.
Yeah, this is like the stuff that doesn't go into the papers that you know, it's like, how do you express these things as part of the paper? Like, there's so many intricate, but this is why, you know, when it comes to doing really good in vitro versus in vivo work, there's so many considerations in that spectrum of once you start to go in vitro, which you need to do to get to a lot of these very mechanistic type of insights. In a large part, you can make the cells, the slices, do what you want, right? Because you have relative total control over the ionic compositions, the internal solution, the external solution. Like, and so how do you best mimic an in vivo environment within an in vitro network is always like a very challenging thing to do. And, you know, as best I could in a lot of my papers, I try to go from in vitro to all the way in vivo, because my background is in vivo, you know, whole animal, large animal, goats. And so you can't ever rule out the fact that we might have a cool drug that works, but if you put it in there and the goat turns into, you know, this headbutting angry zombie, then, you know, it doesn't really help you. And there's a lot of times as you get this huge response in vitro, you know, in a dish, and then you stick the drug in. There's so many times that we have some beautiful in vitro data of this drug that's supposed to reverse opioids or whatever. And then we do it, let's say in a goat or even in a whole mouse or something like that. And you give the drug and it just, you're having a staring contest with the animal for 3 hours and nothing happens. And you're like, well.
But does the headbutting angry zombie goat ever happen? That's what I want to know.
It does. Yes. Yes.
Yikes.
There are some drugs that, you know, you can't rule out intracranial pressure and stuff like that, but there are some drugs that have some behavioral effects that are, you know, sort of confounding to the point that it's, you know, they're not useful anymore. But anyways, it's just sort of something to keep in mind when you're interpreting all in vitro studies, was how, you know, how relevant is this towards an actual
animal system, if that's the question that you're asking, you know. So, and that was certainly the question that we were trying to get after. But anyways, the point is that in vivo systems have a lot of redundant networks that are compensating for things, and many mammals are very robust at keeping alive. Like, they're very good at keeping themselves from not being unalive. And so there's a lot of ways that the physiology will play tricks on you.
I actually had a question, at the foundational level of this. So you were looking at the, we'll call it pre-Boetzinger. Is that how we're saying with the umlaut, Boetzinger? Boetzinger?
I call it pre-Boetzinger, but I think it's pre-Boetzinger. I think that is the correct term. It was actually termed, so Jack Feldman from UCLA was the sort of, his lab and the group were the ones that coined that area. And it's called pre-Boetzinger because it's right next to the Boetzinger complex, which, you know, so one is for largely for inspiration, the other is for expiration. But Boetzinger is actually a wine that is made that they were drinking at the time that coined the term. And so they were drinking the Boetzinger wine. It's somewhere from the California region. And when they decided that they needed to name this area, and so it became the Boetzinger and the pre-Boetzinger complex. And so that's where the name came from. And then turns out I talked to Jack and I said, you know, is it a good wine or anything? Is it, oh no, it's terrible.
This is what happens when you drink alcohol in labs. You make bad decisions.
Cheap wine aside, that is that's something that is looking at rhythmic or like tidal breathing. Is that at all controlling like conscious respiration as well? Or is it kind of looking at autonomic only, or is it a mix? I know I should know, but I do not.
No, that's the ongoing question. I mean, that is the one of the questions in the field right now is what's controlling actual conscious breathing? We don't know. We have no idea. And so largely the pre-Boetzinger complex is, you're right, it's unconscious autonomic breathing. So it's very much running the show 99% of the time when you're not thinking about breathing, when you're sleeping, things like that are very much being driven by the pre-Boetzinger complex. But interestingly enough, if you acutely knock out the pre-Boetzinger complex, or you stick in a neurotoxin, which they did this in rats and rabbits and mice and goats, actually in the lab that I did my dissertation in, when you acutely perturb that part of the brain, you get fatal apnea. It's a terminal apnea right away. If you lesion it slowly over time, though, then you don't actually need that area to breathe, but you do have large defects in the ability to breathe, especially during sleep. And so it's very much driving that sort of autonomic center, if you will. But as far as like the conscious breathing, we really have no idea, because you have the ability to just override it. Like, if I want to breathe, I can just breathe. And so like, it's very much intertwined within sort of, breathing is kind of split between like rhythm and pattern generation. And so like rhythm being sort of the pace of breathing, which is largely driven by the pre-Boetzinger complex, but the pattern of breathing is sort of like how you shape your inspiration, your expiration, and how it, you know, each breath kind of lines up with one another, things like that. That's largely driven by some other sort of meta central pattern generating system that we don't quite know. But there does seem to be a conscious part to it, because we can just turn it on and turn it off. But there is a point where I like to think of it kind of like, you know, like in some of those cars, they have those slap shifters where you can like, it's an automatic car, but if you want to like slap it into slap shift, like it can kind of, you can shift it by yourself if you want. But if the RPMs start to get too low or too high, it'll force you to shift by yourself or like by itself. And so it's sort of like training wheels with a manual. It's kind of like that, right? Because you can hold your breath, but at a certain point, like you can't hold your breath to the point that you die voluntarily. So it'll just do it for you. Yeah, going back to the actual bursts themselves. So the original figure in the paper itself was showing the variability to the opioids, because for a long time, most papers that were looking at opioid-induced respiratory depression, like I said, the opioids, the primary way that they cause death is by shutting down this pre-Boetzinger, this wine region within the brainstem. And so you can't generate these rhythmic oscillations anymore. And that's a problem because it drives your autonomic breathing. And so, especially if you become unconscious from the opiates, now you no longer have a functioning pre-Butzinger complex, and then your brain forgets to breathe and you pass. With the studies that have been looking at the mechanisms driving that respiratory depression, of course, they've been looking at, you know, which sort of ion channels are being opened from the opiates, all that kind of stuff, like different neuromodulatory things. There's always just been an average mean data set that shows a dose-dependent reduction in burst frequency from this area as a function of the dose of opioids. And that's what we have as well. And it does show a beautiful dose-dependent reduction in frequency as a function of the dose of the opioids given. But if you actually dive into the individual data that make up those, and you look at all the different time points, you can see that they're all over the place. Like some slices became faster with the opioids, some became slower, like some of them died right away with very, very small doses of opioids. And some of them got out to, you know, and this, we use Damgo, which is like a synthetic opioid here that works good for slices. But some of them got out to huge doses and didn't even care. And so it was like, hey, look, here's the variability that we see. We can't just take a mean data set, you know, putting a lot of ends together and saying that opioids across the board cause a respiratory suppression. They certainly do. Like we're not refuting that they do. Like they do. They certainly do. And we've measured it here. But the individual variation is gigantic. And so, and it's one of the reasons in the clinic, especially, that causes a big issue for prescribing opioids is because the physician trying to prescribe the opioid, the same amount of opioid that I give you today may have no effect on pain, but tomorrow may have a lethal effect. And so where do you start? How do you compare people? Like it's a huge issue, this variability. And not only prescribing drugs to try to manage pain, but also for scientists like myself and others studying opioids, trying to figure out what they're actually doing. Because, you know, if you get a group of animals suddenly and all six of them have an increase in respiration as a function of the opioid, well, then you're going to spend a long time trying to figure out why opioids increase breathing, you know, in your subsequent 20 animals, when in fact, those ones actually have a depression in breathing. And so you kind of have to treat each animal as an individual. Moving on though, to the next part was, okay, we have all these different slices that have different effects to the opioids. Why is one more sensitive than the other? Getting towards sort of the meat of it. And that is where we started to figure out, how do we actually define the state of the neural network? Like, how do you take one neural network and you know that it's different than another one, right? Because it's in a different animal or something like that. But you know that this one had a huge response to the opioids and this one had a not huge response to the opioids. But when you look at them in a dish, I mean, they're both just gray gloops. Like, what's the difference? Like, we have no idea. And so one of the things that we did and is somewhat common, I guess, in computational neural networks, it's less common in sort of in vivo slice preparations, or even in vivo work to try to define the excitability state of a network. But oftentimes in computational networks, which is where we got the idea from, was there's somewhat of a quantitation of the excitability state of neural networks. And so what I mean is that within this particular neural network or within others, you have sort of a mixture of neurons that are within it. And so you had, and all of those neurons have different phenotypic properties. And so some of the neurons are just silent. They're just hanging out within the neural network. They're just sort of freeloaders. And then every time a big wave of depolarization comes through, they jump on the bandwagon and sort of amplify that response. Right. And so those are sort of the silent neurons. And then you have some tonic neurons that are just like pop, 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 pop. Like they're just the crowd. Like they're just always, they won't shut up. They're just pop, 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 pop. No real like rhythmic activity to them other than the fact that they're just always spiking. And then you have sort of the superstars of the group, which are, you know, the bursting neurons that just every once, they have these sort of slow depolarizing waves and then they just go and, you know, fire these big trains of action potentials and sort of synchronize everything up. So that's sort of like the idea of it. And all of these neurons within this network are synaptically connected to one another. And so even though these like tonically spiking neurons are sort of seemingly unimportant because they're just sort of background noise, every time that they're sending an action potential, they're slightly depolarizing the neurons that are eventually going to contribute to the bursting, right? And so they can sort of affect how what the threshold is, if you will, of this network's ability to actually form these bursts, which tell you to take a breath. And so one of the parameters in some of the neural net or the computational networks is they call it a G tonic, which is essentially just, you know, how strong is this tonic excitatory component to the overall network. And so that gives you sort of a quantitative measure of, okay, if I increase sort of the broad, you know, in air quotes, excitability of the network, or as I like to think about it, like the threshold at which you can elicit a breath, you know, so a lower threshold to elicit a breath would be a higher excitability state because it takes less input to give a breath. We've actually done like optogenetic studies. And when you change the excitability state of the network, the amount of laser stimulation that's necessary to make you breathe becomes less as the excitability goes up, if that makes sense, which is good, like in terms of like, you know, if you're having opioids that have a low, an effect of lowering the excitability of everything, it's pretty good to raise it up, you know, but at the same time, you don't want this network to go into a seizure. And so it certainly has a double-edged sword to it, because if you enhance the ability or the excitability of this network too much, then you no longer have rhythmic activity because it's just seizing. And so what we did is whenever you take a brainstem slice out, like I said, it has to go in the brain Gatorade and there that artificial cerebral spinal fluid, and you have the ability to change the ionic composition of it. And so in order to make up for the fact that you no longer have a cerebral cortex, you have to supplement extracellular potassium. And the reason that you do that is because, sort of like you were talking about with the conscious modulation of breathing, there are always synaptic connections coming from sort of the higher cerebral cortex areas, synapsing onto these brainstem regions, affecting their excitability. And when you remove them, the excitability state goes way down. And so in order to supplement for that, you typically, in brainstem slices, raise the extracellular potassium. Normal is 3 millimolar. You raise it up to about 8 millimolar, which in a normal individual would cause somewhat of a lethal seizure. But it sort of just brings the, it just sort of supplements what's been lost from cutting out the brain. Because as much as you want to just take out a slice of a brainstem and say that it's totally normal, it is just the brainstem with everything else cut off. So, you know, a half hour ago, it was in an animal and now it's just sort of hanging out by itself in a dish. So you kind of have to make it feel at home again. But the nice thing is that you have to raise the potassium up sequentially. You can't just like, you can't just go from 3 to 8, bam, like it's just kaboom. Like it's just too much. You'll have fireworks instead of neurons. And so you have to sort of initially raise it up slowly. But so what we did is we recorded the activity from that brainstem region as we were raising the excitability up, because anytime that you're increasing extracellular potassium, you're stepwise increasing the excitability of neurons. So for anyone unaware, potassium is normally much greater inside the cell than outside the cell. And when you raise the potassium outside the cell, it tends to push potassium from coming out of the cell. And so it keeps it inside the cell. Potassium has a positive charge. And so the more positive charge you have in the neuron, the more excitable it is. And so adding potassium to the brain Gatorade, if you will, sort of prevents potassium from leaking out of the cells and it keeps them at a higher state of excitement. It's like giving a little kid sugar, you know, they're just like, yeah. I mean, that's all we were doing is this is basic neuro 101. I mean, even though it is complicated because it's sort of like you're crossing your eyes and you got your fingers crossed and going, which way is things going? Like you just draw it out. It's just preventing potassium from leaving the cell. So they all become more excited. And so the whole neural network becomes more excited. And well, I mean, it does get a little more complicated than that, but for the most part, like that'll get you 95% of the way. For the most part, enhancing or increasing extracellular potassium is a convenient way to increase the excitability of a neural network, which is sometimes called the G-tonic in computational neural networks. And as a result, it sort of drives more of those silent neurons to become spiking and more of those spike, like those tonic neurons to become bursting. And sort of the phenotypic activity of cells is sort of flexible and it's dependent on a mixture of the tonic component or the excitability component and the, we call them like burst current type of things, but essentially the more bursting current that you have within a neuron, which is driven by ion channels, can increase the probability that they become those rock star cells of the bursting ones. So that's sort of how changing the potassium changes the landscape of the neural network. But anyways, the point is that under very low conditions of excitability with very low G-tonic or very low, potassium, the network is comprised only of cells that are mainly silent or a few of them that are starting to just have those like tonic spike activity. The network is very quiet. So if you look at like a raster plot, it's just sort of bare, like there's not a whole lot going on. And then as you increase the potassium, some of those cells start to spike. So you start to get tonic activity in some of those cells and you increase the potassium even further. Now some of those cells that are tonically active start to get excitable enough to the point that it's starting to elicit bursts, which is now you're starting to actually get breaths. And then as you keep increasing the potassium even more, now there's the excitability is so high that the network is no longer able to send those bursts. And now it's just totally full of tonic activity and just sort of in a sort of a seizure-like activity. And so the fact that we had to go from 3 to 8 millimolar in all of those slices gave us an ability to quantitate sort of the level of excitability within the slices at their baseline, because we could take the slice out, we could look at it first, then we could increase the excitability within the network. And we know that the neurons are going to go from silent to tonic to bursting, or silent to bursting to tonic. So like we can sort of get an idea of how excitable was that brain actually to begin with, because we know that we're sort of forcing it in a reproducible way. And so we can sort of look at, all right, if we have a scale of excitability, like where this brainstem slice may have started, once we start to increase the potassium, how did it behave as we're increasing the potassium? And that gives us an idea of where it started on that scale to begin with. And so the question was really, is that does the baseline state of excitability within the networks determine how it responds to the opioids? Because what it seemed to be is that all of these slices moved in a reproducible way, but they all started on different parts of the scale as far as where they were along that spectrum of excitability. And so some slices we took out were only like, you know, moderately excited to begin with, and you gave them a little bit of potassium and suddenly they're in rave mode, you know, they're in a full seizure. And other ones, like it took a ton of potassium before they even started to talk to us, you know, and so they were very, very low on the excitability state. And what it turned out is that you sort of form this, what we called the rhythmogenic or sort of curve of rhythm generation for the brainstem slices. And that's what figure two is, if anyone has the paper. Figure two is sort of the curve of rhythm generation of, we call it the stability curve. So basically like the stability of a network is dependent on the excitability. And so when we just look at those big bursts, not all bursts are the same size. Sometimes you have these weak bursts. Sometimes you have these big, strong ones. And so as the excitability of the network is really low, you have sort of these weak, irregular rhythms. And so you have sort of these just sort of pity little bursts and that are very kind of irregular. And so as you increase the excitability, those bursts become stronger and the network becomes more stable. So you get these big instead of these little weird ones. And then as you become overexcited, now instead of being stable, it's erratic. So now it's just like bursting all over the place. And so you can look at the stability as having sort of this inverse curve type of function, where as you increase the excitability, you have a weak rhythm originally, then you get a big, strong one. And then as you increase it more over, then the stability starts to go down again. And so you can look at being on the right side of that curve is like you're running away from a bear, sort of in like a hyper adrenalized state. Everything's erratic, but everything's moving fast. On the left side is like you're sleeping, right? So anyone that's not interested in neural listening to this right now has a very much low excitability state network, and that is bad for your opioid response. But that was sort of a foundational concept that we were able to find within neural networks, and is using the stability of rhythm generation as a way to quantitate the excitability of the network. Because, you know, changes in excitability are always known, but it's like, how do you control for that? You have no way to control for that. But you know, once we took all of the slices and we normalized them to their excitability state, the response to the opioids was identical across all of them. Like, it wasn't like the opioids were doing the same thing to all of them, but it was that they were all starting at a different state. And so once you normalize the state of the network, the response to opioids was very, very predictable. And so that was sort of the basic science finding of it, was that the network itself actually has reproducible patterns of excitability. But the amount of extrinsic excitation coming into the network, you know, we use the potassium in the in vivo, in the whole system, you know, it's the amount that's coming from your cerebral cortex, some that are coming from your even cerebellum, stuff like that. All of these have sort of these synaptic inputs into these networks that change the excitability and state of the network. And it's different across everybody, you know? And so we were just able to sort of quantitate different states of the network within a dish. And that's what drove the opioid responses.
Why were these slices in different states to begin with?
That's a good question. That's what everybody asked. I have no idea.
Could you stress out a mouse and then sack it and then do this? And
so this was this, you know, it's funny that you mentioned, because this is actually, and I had a grant on this. And this is largely what formed the basis of my entire postdoc work, was and it's forming the basis of what a lot of my work in my lab will be focused on, is looking at the state dependency of these rhythmic neural networks that drive our breathing, and how does it affect sort of drug and disease interactions? Because, like, for example, with the opioids, if we force a brainstem, the prebotzinger complex in this case, so we force that network into a state of hyper excitability, we can do that optogenetically. We can do that by giving norepinephrine, like adrenaline. You know, that's what I meant when running away from a bear. I mean, you're hyperadrenalized and stuff. So, like, there's many different ways to do that, but they all prevent the opioid-induced respiratory suppression, because the opioids just slow, like, the opioids just reduce the excitability. And so when we add the opioids, it's no different than taking, you know, a slice that we had at a hyper-excitability state and just, like, removing the potassium, if you will. I mean, they're different mechanisms of doing it, but essentially you're just moving it backwards along that excitability curve. And so if we make the slices super excited, give them the opioids, they can withstand huge amounts of opioids. And the opioids, in fact, in that case, actually stabilize the rhythm, because remember, they're erratic at that point. Like, they're hyper excited. You give the opioids, it actually restabilizes the activity. And it was interesting, because some of the older literature actually was looking at using opioids as a way of, you know, controlling seizure-like activity. Which was interesting, because you sort of have these networks that are run away from too much excitability, give them the opioid, and it just sort of, and so that you could actually use, like, morphine and fentanyl, buprenorphine, any of these opioids to control, like, a panic attack, for example. I mean, they don't do it anymore, but you can, right. And it's not recommended to do it anymore for sure, but it is a way to sort of quiet overactive neural networks. And so that's why when you have a neural network that's super low excitable to begin with, it takes very, very little opioids and they just shut off. And so the idea, though, was building off of this. We did it with potassium in a dish, which is very much an exogenous application, non-physiological, because we're, you know, using 8 millimolar potassium. What in a group of animals, I injected them with norepinephrine first, got them super hyperadrenalized, and then gave the opiate, and the opioid had, all it did was restabilize the breathing. It didn't have any opioid-induced respiratory suppression. And so there was minimal risk, if you will, for actually having the overdose from the respiratory effects at that point. Now, dealing with mice after you've given them an injection of norepinephrine is a whole different ballgame. But the first time I did it, I didn't even think, you know, it had been a while since I'd done some, like, really whole animal type of stuff. And so I grabbed the mouse and I thought, okay, this makes sense. Like, if we put the network in a hyperexcited state, the opioids are going to come in and they're going to, you know, bring it back into normalville, and you're not going to have the suppression. And it makes sense, right? From a physiological perspective, like, you stub your toe or you got your hand or your arm chopped off, like, you need that endogenous release of opiates in order to actually suppress the pain, right? Or if you break your clavicle in jujitsu, like, you had just certainly have an endogenous release of opioids that does a pretty good job at managing the pain acutely. But along with that, you also have this huge release of adrenaline, norepinephrine, right? And so the overall net effect within the respiratory network in the whole animal system is you have the endogenous opioids, enough that's being released to very severely suppress respiration. But in the face of that norepinephrine, you don't get any suppression of breathing. And so it sort of makes sense that you have this sort of endogenous system in order to be able to control the excitability within very important regions. To answer your question, we gave norepinephrine before the opiates, and it prevented the suppression from occurring. We also gave potassium channel antagonists in order to sort of mimic the effect of the exogenous potassium that we were doing before. And so if I gave tetraethyl ammonium, for example, it just blocks all potassium channels. So if you block a potassium channel, you just prevent the potassium from leaving the cell. And if you do that, the cells become more excited. So that's why for things that are like targeted towards the kidneys, for example, you oftentimes have to, like, because the kidneys are very much involved in balance of ions and sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium, chloride, all that kind of stuff. And if you give a potassium channel antagonist, which blocks potassium channels, which may be good for hyper or hypokalemia, depending on how you're managing your potassium levels in your blood or for your blood pressure. The problem sometimes is that it does it in all cells. And so in the heart and in the brain, it also is blocking the potassium channels. And as a result, the potassium can't leave the cell. And so the cells have more positive charge inside the cell and they become hyperexcited. And so that's what you can have seizures and stuff. So like tetraethyl ammonium, for example, was very good at preventing the opioid-induced respiratory suppression, but it was on the face of a seizure. So, I mean, like...
You just get to die. You get to die in a different way.
You get to... Yeah, see? Sorry. So you get to pick. So essentially, you know, that formed kind of the basis for a lot of the work, sort of, you know, my lab going forward has kind of two aims. And one of those is looking at how the state dependency of these neural networks affects the response to different drugs and environmental exposures. And so, you know, there's many, you know, what I often say is that there's many, many different ways in order to prevent the shutdown of respiratory activity in the face of opioids, but all of them sort of have a common cause as to changing the excitability of that network. And so it's always sort of this balance of how much excitability do you add in to offset the reduction in excitability from the opioids. And the biggest thing is, how do we actually make that specific? Because like I said, even if you're targeting the kidneys, oftentimes you're having the same effect on the brain. And so how do you actually target that group of neurons?
One of the things that kind of struck me, and it's not necessarily a question, I guess the question is, how do you get motivated to move past this? Because when I look at the variability of the like state and how you're adding potassium to get it to like, You're finding the rhythm, basically. You're finding the stability point, but there's so much variability in getting what would be the data sample to that point. And for me, I would just think like, oh man, no one's going to love this. This is just, they're going to say this is data soup. Cause you know, when you get into the peer review part, you never really know. You could have a peer reviewer say that, you know, there's too much variability in this, even though you found like the controlled stability point. So is it just kind of like, go for it? No, trust the thing that you're doing and continue on? Or was there some danger that everything is going to kind of get thrown out at that point?
I mean, there was a lot that's been thrown out, I shouldn't say that. I should back up and say that I think the danger was that we weren't throwing anything out. And we're just saying that, you know, here's all the brainstems. How do we create something that is going to work for all brainstem states, regardless of where they're at? Because like when you're looking at, especially for these type of studies, it becomes a matter of, I like to try to keep the studies very translational if possible, as far as like one or two steps from the clinic, if we can, just because from a physiology perspective, I that's what works best for my brain. Like you have this and then we can say, okay, great. But how do we actually define the state of the network in a patient prior to giving opiates? Because we can't take the brain out and, you know, increase the potassium within it, you know? And so it becomes somewhat of a, what can we conjugate with the opioid in order to sort of broad scale prevent the suppression of the opioid induced respiratory suppression from actually occurring. So can we, let's say, take an excitability modulator, something that blocks potassium channels, something that enhances sodium channels, for example, and can we give that alongside the opiate in order to allow the opioid to kill the pain, but also not have it shut down the respiratory network? The danger with that, of course, is that, like you said, there's variability. And so if we give something that increases the excitability of the neural network to someone that already has a hyperexcited network, well, now you're going to have pain relief plus a seizure, or now you're going to have, you know, pain relief plus some secondary effect of hyperexcitation. And that's something that's still to be determined, if you will. And so like one of the methods that we used in here, and one of the things that, you know, my lab will be using going forward a lot, is some of these multi-electrode array recording systems. And so, but anyways, there are these high density silicone arrays that allow you to measure activity from like 390 something neurons at a time, rather than just, you know, patch clamping, which is like one at a time. And so it gives you more of a broad scale look at the network of saying how many of these neurons are actually tonically spiking and bursting and silent, and, you know, how does their activity shift? And so I should say, like, when we figured out that they were shifting from silent to bursting to tonic, we had a neural probe in the brain recording from, you know, 100 of the neurons at the same time within this network. And we actually just watched them transition from these activity patterns. So we weren't just making that up.
When you're talking about like the clinical translational aspect of this research, could you, like, under supervision in a controlled environment, like, titrate patients and find out what their baseline kind of excitability state or their baseline like susceptibility to opioids is? So you could find out, like, you know, okay, we're gonna keep this person in the like pain clinic for a day, a week, for a couple of weeks, and we're going to like slowly titrate their opioid dose. And we're going to find out, like, oh man, you know, their, you know, baseline state is really, really, really susceptible to opioids. And so we need to be very careful. We need to keep the dose low, or we need to give this like modulator on top of it, right? That's going to make the state more excitable and then sort of bring it back down to a normal area with the opioids. Or you find out that someone's really, really not susceptible, and you're like, okay, we don't need to put the like excitatory stuff on top of this, you're good to go, right? I mean, like, I guess this is the problem that you'd probably run into with that is the way that the healthcare system is, but hypothetically, I guess, could you do that?
I think yes and no. I think the issue is not necessarily across individual variability, but within individual variability as well. And so there's both inter and intra variability problems when it comes to the opiates. And so, like, one of the big problems is the contextual overdose phenomenon. And so, like we know that individuals that are taking opiates, like recreationally, for example, in a novel environment, like they're at a new party or something like that, have a much higher incidence of overdose versus that of taking them at home. I mean, that begs the question of sort of this neural network priming that the cortex sort of, like we know, has descending modulatory input into these brainstem regions to set the overall state of excitation. And it's going to be, you know, when you're in a familiar environment, you're always taking the opioid in the same part of your house, sitting down on the couch, the same spot, or in the bathroom or something like that, then the odds of overdosing are much lower, likely because the network can somewhat predict that the opioid is about to occur and start to ramp up the neuromodulatory buffering, if you will, to prevent complete shutdown. Versus in a novel environment, you no longer have sort of this anticipation of the drug, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon in and of itself. But the idea there then is, like, you know, within a controlled environment, the rate of overdose is much lower in the sense that you can titrate and you can get an idea of whether or not the overdose is going to be occurring. The problem is once you leave those controlled environments, now you don't know the environment, you don't know the state of the network anymore. And so, like, clinically, yeah, there might be able to be a way, at least somewhat in the near term, in order to look at some of these multi neuronal recording type of array systems as they become less and less invasive, in order to get a snapshot of the state of that neural network as far as the electrical activity within it, which may be able to predict the effect of a bolus dose in surgery. But I think extrapolating that out into, you know, recreational opioid use is now going to be a problem, because, you know, how do you take like an electrical reader type of activity sticker and stick it on the back of the neck and then get an idea of the neural network state before you take an opiate recreationally? I think that's a big ask. The other point of the other arm of my research programs is the systemic effects of the opioid, which are just as deadly as the central effects. And so when patients are overdosing on opioids, one of the things that happens a lot of times is called wooden chest syndrome. And so this is where you get rigidity, like muscular rigidity of most of the breathing muscles and things like this. And so you get like tonic contraction of the diaphragm, the intercostals, the abdominal, the airways collapse. And so suddenly you have this completely rigid, like chest is just, that's why they call it wooden chest syndrome. And that is largely insensitive to the effects of naloxone or Narcan. And so for a lot of the patients that end up dying from the overdose, Narcan was on board, right? And it reversed the central effects of the opiate, but you can, you know, if you, the signal to breathe can be restored, but if that's on top of a non-compliant respiratory system, you don't have breathing. And at the same time, if you have reversal of the rigidity of the respiratory network or the respiratory system itself, the physiology, but you don't have a central respiratory drive, then you're not going to be breathing. So it's sort of a twofold aspect. And so where a lot of my work, like this paper was done, I think like 3 or 4 years ago, a lot of my work now is focused on the airway effects in the actual lungs themselves, because what we're finding is that when we're overdosing a lot of these animals in order to try to understand reversals, the effects on the airways are so strong that you have to overcome those. And not only that, but like you can conjugate the opioid, for example, like with a bronchodilator to prevent the lungs from, you know, to prevent the airways from collapsing. So that way, even if you have super dilation of the airways, very small rates of respiration are still enough to keep you oxygenated to prevent you from dying. But the nice part about that is it doesn't immediately reverse the effects centrally. And so you're not getting that acute withdrawal that happens a lot of times, because a lot of patients are, even in an overdose type of situation, I guess recreationally, hesitant to use the Narcan because you go into a withdrawal immediately. And so it's one of the problems in the back of the EMT trucks is that when you have a patient that's overdosed, you're trying to titrate the Narcan to a point where the patient is still unconscious, but not at the point of death, right? Because when you give that full sledgehammer of Narcan, the rate of violence in the back of the ambulances skyrockets. Patients become very agitated. I mean, they go into withdrawal immediately. And so if we can give something that can keep them breathing while the opioid can just run its course, I think that's a fruitful way to go. And that's what a lot of my projects have sort of morphed into as of lately in the last papers that we've been publishing. So it's just something that's worth. And the nice thing about that is now you're dealing with an overdose treatment that may be easier to push per se, because it doesn't completely send you into withdrawal immediately.
And it also requires follow-up medical care. You really should get follow-up medical care if you get Narcan, but you can just decline treatment, right? If someone gives you Narcan, 911's there, the ambulance is there later, they're like, you should go to the hospital. You can be like, no, I'm going to leave. It's not recommended, but you could do that. This is like, you can't really have it be a street level public health intervention, because it still requires, you're still unconscious and it still requires like close monitoring.
Yeah, that's the tough part. How do you push the treatments? Like I said, there's a lot of different ways to reverse it. There's, you know, we can push a lot of different neuromodulators. We can push a lot of different agonists, antagonists. We know how to keep that network bursting and we know how to keep the airways open. That's not an issue. The issue is, well, I mean, one, the issue is how does it actually work, so we can create something that's more specific, that's actually safe to implement to the masses. But two is like, how do you implement that to the masses? And a large part, unfortunately, is that there's a pretty big gap in between the science that's being done for the treatments and the actual public policy itself. Like, it's very divided. And that's something that would be nice to be a little bit more mended. But I think that's also going to be kind of a regional specificity as well.
I think, I mean, that kind of points to the the importance of science communicators being involved in policy advocacy too.
So that's the opioid story.
Boy, is it the opioid story where it's just all over the place, right?
It's all over the place, yeah. And I think the cool thing is that we saw how much evolved out of a simple project of put some slices in a dish and see what reverses the opioids. And I think that's, I think like it's cool in the fact that a lot of times when you come into a new lab, for example, you just sort of want to do the project, get the data and just roll along. And it sort of calls to asking questions and being skeptical and trying to understand why certain things work and not just taking the data and just like, here it is.
I see that we found something interesting here. I'm curious where you go next from here. What do you want to look at next? Because you found, you know, and more information about the variability and of the responses we see and explanation of it. But where do we go from here? Because, you know, the ultimate goal is better treatment. And what's the next step in the research?
Yeah, I think, you know, when it comes to the variability in the neural networks, a lot of this project is kind of evolved into looking at how the respiratory network itself can form different states and how it changes based on the neuromodulatory environment that it is in at any given time. And so, like I said, that goes more into sort of the basic concept. That's more of a basic science type of question of how does the respiratory network display this acute and chronic adaptability or flexibility in the excitability of the neurons themselves? And what are the different conditions that causes it to be in one state versus the other? And so, like, can we drive the natural endogenous release of norepinephrine, you know, under certain chronic states of stress, for example, or chronic pain? And so can we start to expand that into understanding, okay, let's say that there's some patient that is in chronic pain, for example, they may have a heightened state of noradrenaline under normal conditions. And so they might be able to handle acutely higher doses of opioids. But as that chronic pain becomes more tolerable, do we need to wean the opiates as a function of not a tolerance for the opiates, but as a function of the norepinephrine from the chronic pain leaving, for example? And can we expand that out into different situations, you know? And so maybe someone that's more stressed, less stressed, maybe they have some sort of problem with arousal, for example. You know, there's many conditions that affect sort of that whole reticular activating system. And we know that if you have sort of a lethargic type of patient that has a problem with that, then they might not be able to handle as many opiates. But just sort of figuring out how endogenous modulation of the excitability of that network actually works, because we really don't know that at the moment. We have no idea. And so we have some different optogenetic and tracing models looking at the different. So basically, like, we have some studies going on where we're injecting retrograde labelers and retrograde controllers, if you will, into the pre-Butzinger complex that traces specific subsets of neurons of a specific neurotransmitter that project down into that region. And when we either specifically control the release of them with light, or if we elicit the behavioral response that elicits the release of a specific neurotransmitter into the pre-Butzinger complex, we can then follow that up with a probe that can measure the activity of that neurotransmitter within that region, within the pre-Butzinger complex. And we can see how changing the balance of those neuromodulators changes the effects of the opiates. And again, it just sort of is getting at the idea of, is there a way to quickly understand the behavioral state of that patient before the opiate, or to understand, you know, in a chronic state of alcoholism or something like that, how do we have to address the overdose, or how do we have to address the prescription? So that's a lot more sort of like on the clinical basis of the opioid management. From the airway perspective, like I was talking about, that I see is more the acute reversal as far as like recreational, and as far as also like, let's say, surgical or something like that, where you're getting a bigger bolus of the opiate. So that's looking at, you know, how how does the opioid itself and its modulation of the excitability of these neural networks now expand out into the different neural networks? Because opioids are not just affecting the pre-Bott-Singer complex. They're affecting everything that express the opioid receptor. And so, you know, we see like the airways are collapsing. We see this muscular rigidity. And how do we prevent that from actually occurring? Because that's more straightforward in the fact that the airways close off, we need to open them back up. Like that's a pretty, we know what's happening, or we know the phenomenon that's happening. We know the goal. We just have to figure out how it's happening and how we can reverse that. And so like, you know, we were giving, in one of the studies, we were giving epinephrine and, or like an EpiPen, as well as salbutamol, which is albuterol, like a rescue inhaler. And when you give that alongside the opiate, like you can completely prevent the airways from collapsing themselves. And so we have some idea that there's some sort of overactive parasympathetic activity happening because we can remove a lot of it if we cut the vagus nerve. So I obviously don't want to do that in a patient, but
who needs your vagus nerve?
I guess you'd also have to look at how quickly can you get to the vagus nerve? Like I'm a pretty good dissector, but I think not before, you know, death.
Yeah, it used to be a treatment for asthma, interestingly enough, but
cutting the vagus nerve was?
Yeah, they did vagotomies for asthma because, you know, you take deeper breaths and slower breaths when it comes to, and so you also, when you reduce the cholinergic drive to the airways, you cut the vagus nerve, there's no more cholinergic drive, you don't get the airway constriction. They don't do that anymore.
The vagus nerve does a lot of other stuff though.
Yeah, yeah, they had some heart and blood pressure problems, some gut problems. So yeah, I've been doing patch clamping stuff right now in many of those different motor nuclei. And so like we've been recording from some of the motor neurons that are coming from, or I guess going through the vagus nerve and driving the different airways and things like that. And when you get fentanyl, they actually, a lot of them are seemingly depolarizing instead of hyperpolarizing. So they're becoming more excitable with the fentanyl. And so that begs the question of why is that happening? Everything that you hypothesize is opposite. We have a grant on that studying what type of disinhibition is happening. So like if there's neurons that are projecting to those neurons that express the opioid receptor, if you inhibit them and they're normally inhibiting the motor neurons, then the motor neurons actually become active. That's one. There's another project that's looking at whether or not the opiate can actually fit into a potassium channel itself. So we'll kind of see how the cookie crumbles as that one, you know, turns out. Yeah. So that's looking at more of those acute airway, but taking what we know from these pre-Bott-Singer complex neural network stories and putting it into motor nuclei, like especially like we're doing the vagus nuclei and the different NTS, and they call them nucleus ambiguous areas, which are you know, aptly named region of big motor neurons in the middle of the brainstem that they just said, no, it looks ambiguous. That's nucleus ambiguous. So that's the name.
What was a cool or interesting thing, Gabby and James, that you have taken away from today? Something you maybe want to learn more about in the future about this area of research?
I mean, I definitely want to learn so much more about brain Gatorade. That's definitely something I need to learn more about. Both the funny answer of like, what color do you use? Is it the, I always preferred the lemon lime, but it's amazing. It's amazing that you can just kind of put brain, like neuronal cells, brain stems into a bit of liquid and have it kind of be alive for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to bubble oxygen too. These are some of the most complicated solutions I've ever made because the balance needs to be all correct.
I mean, I learned a lot of interesting things today, but I think I want to learn more about wooden chest syndrome. I like that term. Obviously, it's something bad. So I don't like the fact that it's a thing. But I don't know. It was something new and interesting to me. A new way to die from opioids, to my knowledge.
Well, before we go, I know James and Nick, at least you two, have some things to plug. So I guess, and Gabby, do you have anything to plug? Do you have some pluggables?
I really don't have pluggables. I mean, I'm barely online. I deleted all my social media accounts, so really, I have nothing. I have nothing to say about that.
Great. Well, let's start with James then. What have you got going on?
Oh, I have this podcast called Science Night, and you can learn so much about it at scinight.com. That's SCINIGHT.com. And, you know, I'm on Twitter X. The links are on that website. I wish I could delete all my social medias. Maybe I can do that next, but I'll keep the website. So scinight.com's got everything.
Cool. Check it out. I was actually on a couple weeks ago. It was such a fun time. They do so much banter. And I'm super excited because I'm officially going to Gen Con and you guys are going to be at Gen Con.
We're going to be at Gen Con. Yeah. Yeah. That's hey, early pluggable. We're going to be talking about the science behind Super Mario Brothers at Gen Con, presented by Indiana Sciences. So come out and see it. The tickets aren't on sale yet, but it's fun.
That sounds interesting. I don't know what the science behind Super Mario Brothers could possibly be. I want to know more already.
Oh, there's going to be lots of mushroom based jokes. That's for sure.
All right. Nick, what do you got going on?
Yeah. For as far as podcasts, I got The Neural Network. I'm not sure if the website is still up right now, theneuralnetwork.org, if it is, but we're in the process of making a new website at the moment. But yeah, you can find us on all major podcast players. We got The Neural Network on Instagram. Just got links at Nick Burgraff also for Instagram, Twitter X, if you will. That's pretty much where you can find a lot of that stuff. Like I said, I'm at Seattle Children's for a little while until later this summer when, we'll be transitioning to University of Wisconsin-Madison for the Burgraff Lab opening up. And so I guess sort of in the interim between that, which is exciting and terrifying at the same time.
That's super exciting. Go check out both of their podcasts. And thank you all for being on this podcast. We've been talking about the paper, Dynamic Rhythmogenic Network States Drive Differential Opioid Responses in the In Vitro Respiratory Network by Nicholas J. Burgraff et al. Our expert has been the Nicholas Burgraff, and our guests have been James and Gabby. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Plain English Sci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.
Only do your opioids when you're being chased by a bear.
I mean, that might interfere with my ability to escape the bear is the problem.
Maybe that's it. Maybe we go downtown and we just release some bears. And then we see the opioid overdoses go way down. And we can scale up. You start with like a red panda, small things, and then the risk exponentially increases. We move to a sun bear and a black bear and then eventually the grizzly.
If I get to...
I was gonna say, I would not run away from a red panda. If I see a red panda, yeah. I'm scritching it.